NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Lulu Garcia Navarro. Good morning. Attacks on houses of worship by extremists have left faith communities reeling. We'll speak with three faith leaders about how they're keeping their congregations safe. When Helen Wong began writing her first novel with an autistic main character, she discovered something that transformed her own life. We'll get her incredible story this hour. And it is the beginning of commencement season, and for some, it has been a long road filled with detours and roadblocks. In Montana, one woman has something special to be proud of. It's Sunday, May 5th. Ramadan begins tonight in much of the Muslim world. News is coming up in this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered massive strikes against militant groups in Gaza in response to rocket fire. An Israeli army spokesperson says that Gaza militant groups have launched at least 450 rockets and mortars at Israel, and he said at least 150 were intercepted by Israel's missile defense system. Reporter Naomi Zevaloff is in Tel Aviv.
There have been casualties on both sides. The military spokesman said that a rocket from Gaza killed one Israeli man, and the Gaza Ministry of Health is reporting that Israeli airstrikes have killed multiple people. Two of those people were claimed as militants by a group called Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And among the victims were a pregnant woman and a 14-month-old baby, but there are conflicting accounts over what actually happened. Gaza health officials say that an Israeli airstrike killed them, but the Israeli military spokesman said that a rocket fired by Palestinians that landed inside the strip is what killed them.
Naomi Zevaloff reporting there from Tel Aviv. The fighting threatens Egyptian mediators' efforts to negotiate a long-term ceasefire. North Korea says its leader Kim Jong-un observed Saturday's weapons tests, including what analysts say appear to be a new short-range ballistic missile. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Seoul that such a launch would be the first ballistic missile test since November 2017.
The Korean Central News Agency released pictures of Kim watching from a command post with binoculars. They showed rockets and a short-range missile being fired from mobile launchers. The agency reports that Kim expressed great satisfaction over the tests, which were intended to increase combat readiness and motivate troops to train harder. The tests are also seen as a reminder to the U.S. that if negotiations don't work out, Pyongyang could scrap its moratorium on testing nuclear weapons. President Trump tweeted that Kim Jong-un does not want to break his promise to him to denuclearize, adding optimistically, "Deal will happen." Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
Belgian officials are worried that weapons dumped off the coast after both world wars are now contaminating public waters. Terry Schultz reports from Brussels that officials are trying to figure out how to deal with potentially deadly leaks.
A sandbank just off one of Belgium's most popular beach towns has tested positive for traces of mustard gas and TNT, one of two sites in the country showing signs of contamination. Belgium was a major battlefield in both World Wars I and II, and after hostilities ended each time, stores of weapons were buried in cement-filled containers, some less than a mile off the Belgian coast. These weapons cemeteries contain unexploded bombs, shells, grenades, and mines. They had been considered safe, but environmental activists have warned the casings would eventually leak. The governor of the region is calling for the underwater dump to be immediately cleared, but the mayor of the town, a popular tourist destination, urges against making hasty decisions. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
And you're listening to NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Sharon Brody in Boston. Massachusetts residents are being warned to throw away certain frozen P.F. Chang meals from the grocery store. The company that owns P.F. Chang has issued a nationwide recall on home menu chicken pad thai and chicken fried rice because an allergen in the ingredients is not listed on the packaging. The recall is for products marked with an EST-115 establishment number. New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is getting involved in the select board race in Brookline. The first-term Democrat campaigned in town yesterday for candidate Raul Fernandez. She said leading up to her surprise victory last fall, she found it difficult to campaign in immigrant neighborhoods because residents feared immigration agents.
And I would knock on the door, they'd be really scared, and it would be an older voice, like a mother. And I'd say, like, what do you want, etc. And I'd speak to them in Spanish. So they would be receptive, but they would not open the door. And I would slide literature under the door. for them to get to their kid. And I realized that families were terrified of ICE.
Yep.
Ocasio-Cortez first met Fernandez when he worked at Boston University and she was a BU student. Arlington is the latest town in Massachusetts to ban polystyrene plastic. Residents approved the ban on all polystyrene products, including styrofoam, at a town meeting last week. The Arlington Advocate reports the ban will take effect at the beginning of next year. This comes as Maine has approved a statewide ban on the plastic. In sports, last night the Bruins beat the Blue Jackets 4-3. The Bees lead the playoff series 3-2. Last night the Red Sox beat the White Sox 15-2. They play again this afternoon in Chicago. Last night the Revs lost to Philadelphia 6-1. It's 50 degrees in Boston. Some rain today. Temperatures in the low 50s. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Innuendo. With smartphone-controlled Hunter Douglas PowerView motorized shades in the Window Fashions Gallery. Hunter Douglas at Innuendo Natick and Innuendo.com. Commonwealth Learning Center. One-to-one tutoring specializing in dyslexia, ADHD, and other learning challenges. Details at commlearn.com. And the Joyce Foundation. Committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Good morning. Houses of worship have traditionally been places of refuge, but recent attacks by extremists have targeted people at prayer. Just recently, a shooting at a synagogue near San Diego, bombings at churches in Sri Lanka on Easter Sunday, mass shootings at two mosques in New Zealand, and the attack on the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. Religious leaders are confronting a dual reality. They must take measures to prepare for these attacks and also work from a place of faith and support. We asked three of these faith leaders to tell us what was on their minds, beginning with Rabbi Toba Shaler in Milwaukee.
My community is feeling some fear and stress, and we're working really hard as a community to act from a place of love rather than a place of fear. We have had a sense for a long time that we were at risk because of hatred and violence against Jews and other minorities. It definitely changed after the attack in Pittsburgh at the Tree of Life Synagogue. And after that, our congregants got together and donated money to hire a chief of security for our congregation. And so I think one of the concerns that we all have and that we're talking about is that this is already becoming normalized and a part of life. And that is really concerning to us all. But also as Jews, we believe in a concept, mitzvah, gereret mitzvah, that one deed of justice and love that God commands us to do perpetuates another, and that sins or acts of evil perpetuate more sins and more acts of evil and more negativity. So it really is a Jewish value for us to respond to events like this with loving kindness.
My name is Reverend Ronnell Howard, and I am the pastor of Christ United Methodist Church in Piscataway, New Jersey.
I think just how we blissfully go through life as a Christian church here in the United States, in most parts of the country, not thinking a whole lot about safety and now having to be confronted with it. I remember in one group meeting, one person saying that they had a member who offered to pay for armed security on Sunday mornings, and everyone was in complete angst around it. Oh, what would that look like? And what would that mean? And should the church do it? And all of that. And I remember just saying, are you guys serious? Black churches have always had armed security. And they looked at me so shocked, like, wait, what? I'm like, yeah. Like, as long as I've been in church, and it has never been a given for Black churches that it wouldn't be bombed. We think about Alabama, it wouldn't be burned. We think about Louisiana, or that someone might not come in during Bible study and shoot everyone save one person, right? So with that being the Black experience, I think the Black church is a bit of ahead of the curve on security, whereas in predominantly white spaces, it really comes as a saddening shock. I think the feeling in the room was this sense of loss of safety and security that the people in the room had always kind of counted on.
My name is Imam Omar Suleiman. I am the founder and president of the Yaqeen Institute for Islamic Research and serve in a voluntary capacity as the resident scholar at the Valley Ranch Islamic Center here in Dallas, Texas. My community here in Dallas, Texas has dealt with regular armed white supremacist protests in front of our mosques, and that's been going on for years. And the sad thing about what happened in New Zealand is that no one was surprised that it happened. They were just surprised that it happened in Christchurch, New Zealand. Sadly, we've kind of been bracing ourselves for an attack of that sort here in Texas for a very long time. The worst part about it for me, I mean, the moment that strikes me, and I tend to always see things through the eyes of my kids. When Pittsburgh happened, we all went to the synagogue together that evening. And when Christchurch happened, my kids' Islamic school had a lockdown the next day. And these poor kids were terrified because they thought that the Christchurch shooter had come to their school. And so having that conversation with my 9-year-old daughter was extremely difficult. And so the one safe space is the mosque. That's the place where we get to be us. That's the place where our kids get to run around, not have to worry about how they look or what they're saying. And not only are they finding safety and security and happiness in their mosque spaces, in their Muslim spaces, but they're able to take that happiness and translate it into confidence when they leave those spaces back into places of hostility. The way that we've beefed up security is that we have armed security throughout all of our services, multiple people monitoring different access points of the mosque. So at First United Methodist Church in Dallas, which is the largest Methodist church here, actually trained our mosque's volunteers and staff on how to maintain good security practices while also being welcoming. I mean, that was beautiful. It was solidarity. And, you know, I think we're trying to create a culture. So we would hate to become an unwelcoming space. We're cautious. Our security guards are obviously alert. Our congregation is alert. But when you walk into our mosque, you're getting a big hug.
That was Rabbi Toba Shaler of Milwaukee, Reverend Ronell Howard of Piscataway, New Jersey, and Imam Omar Suleiman of Dallas. There are elections in South Africa Wednesday, and they may be tough for the governing African National Congress. The party is campaigning on the slogan, A Better Life for All, but there are allegations of rampant corruption under former President Jacob Zuma. And it's all happening close to the 25th anniversary of Nelson Mandela's history-making election and the end of apartheid. NPR's Afebia Quist-Arkton is in Johannesburg, and she joins us. Good morning.
Greetings.
What are the stakes there? Just an embarrassment for the ANC, or could there be some kind of sea change in South Africa?
You know, the polls don't predict a sea change, but what President Cyril Ramaphosa, who replaced Jacob Zuma as president last year, is under pressure to do is reverse the slide in support for the governing ANC. And this has been happening over years. And as you've said, the corruption allegations, what the South Africans here call state capture, this was one business family in particular, the Guptas, and it's come to our knowledge that other people also were trying to influence the government. The Gupta family two of the brothers said, even to be appointing cabinet ministers under Jacob Zuma. They deny these allegations, but all this has tarnished the image of the governing ANC. So President Ramaphosa is having to deal with that whilst having to try and hold on to especially the urban areas of South Africa, some of whom are not so keen on the ANC anymore, as we've seen in previous elections.
How is the economy there doing? I mean, how is South Africa doing?
As you know, South Africa, of course, is the second biggest economy in Africa. It's also the most industrialized economy, Lulu. And yet, despite financial services, trade, tourism, mining, of course, a robust informal sector worth millions of dollars, South Africans feel they are struggling and that the governing party has not lived up to the expectations of the ANC's mantra of a better life for all. So this is part of the problem, not just the political problems, but because of the economic uncertainty and a decline in mining production, South Africans are feeling vulnerable and they want a better life. And that's not just the majority black South Africans, but all South Africans, because, of course, this is what Archbishop Desmond Tutu named the Rainbow Nation under Mandela. Many people feel that it has not lived up to that expectation at all.
I mean, it's striking to think that it was only 25 years ago when Nelson Mandela was sworn in as president in that historic moment. What are people feeling about that? What has changed since then?
There was such hope. The formal end of apartheid, which was killing South Africa. Nelson Mandela was in jail, as well as other struggle leaders, for a quarter of a century plus. South Africans, those who came into existence, who were born around the time of the end of apartheid, are now what, 25 plus? And yet you get young South Africans who feel that they are not invested in the future of this country. We're told that young South Africans who make up a majority of eligible voters have not registered to take part in Wednesday's elections. You know, this raises concerns about voter apathy, about people feeling that South Africa, everybody felt invested all over the world in South Africa at the end of apartheid when Nelson Mandela came to power, but that somehow this country has not lived up to those expectations. And even the young people are saying, what's the point of us voting? Youth unemployment is so high. We may go and study, but what future do we have here?
That's NPR's Ophebia Quist-Arkton in Johannesburg. Ophebia, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Lulu. Thank you.
Here's a quick way to support WBUR and honor your mom or the moms in your life. Order Mother's Day Winston flowers at WBUR.org and save 10% right now.
It is 50 degrees in Boston at 9:18. Ahead on Weekend Edition Sunday, voters in Denver decide this week whether or not to legalize psychedelic mushrooms for personal and medical use. That and much more ahead on Weekend Edition. Rain around today in Boston, some patchy fog, and temperatures in the low 50s. This is 90.9 WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Boston Pops with Keith Lockhart, welcoming Rhiannon Giddens for a series on redefining American music, May 22nd to 25th at Symphony Hall, bostonpops.org. Boston University's Graduate Tax Program. Advance your career with an LLM or master's degree in tax law. Open to tax, legal, and business professionals. And Mass Eye and Ear. When sinus problems affect the way you experience life, experience the difference Mass Eye and Ear can make. Locations at masseyeandear.org.
I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered the military to continue massive strikes against militants in Gaza as hostilities stretch into a third day. The Israeli army says more than 450 mortars and rockets have been fired into Israel from Gaza, leading to the death of an Israeli man. Several Palestinians have been killed. North Korean state media say leader Kim Jong-un expressed great satisfaction over Saturday's weapons drills. Today's report report with photos of Kim overseeing the test came a day after South Korea's military said the North launched several short-range projectiles into the Sea of Japan. And crowds lined the streets of Bangkok today as part of coronation activities for Thailand's new king. They gathered to watch the newly crowned king make a ceremonial procession. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Viking, committed to providing carefully curated and culturally enriching journeys sailing Europe's Danube and Rhine rivers. Learn more at vikingcruises.com. From the financial services firm of Raymond James, offering personalized wealth management advice and banking and capital markets expertise, along with a legacy of putting clients' financial well-being first. Learn more at raymondjames.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Caster Semenya won what may be her last 800-meter race this past Friday in Doha. Her dominance in the event may be at an end because of new regulations that come into effect Wednesday. The new rules ban women like Semenya, with naturally occurring high levels of testosterone, from running certain events in the women's competition unless they take medicine to reduce those levels. When asked whether she would submit to the new regulations, Semenya replied, "Hell no." Madeline Pape was an Olympic runner for Australia who once competed against Semenya. She's now a PhD candidate in sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And she told us about when she competed against Semenya in 2009 at the IAAF World Championships in Berlin.
I lost to Semenya amongst other people in the heats. And I was, after that, very quick to join the chorus of voices around me that were beginning to accuse Semenya of having an unfair advantage. And that really reached fever point on the evening of the final when the IAAF, who's our governing body in track and field, announced publicly that they were going to be conducting investigations into Semenya's biological sex. So that really set the tone for how people then proceeded to talk about her. And for me, you know, I guess I wasn't really encountering any alternative points of view. That was the single point of view that was being voiced around me at the time. So I certainly fell in the camp of jumping on the bandwagon and repeating the things that were being said around me.
And how did you come to change your mind?
Yeah, that was it was quite a long journey, actually. About a year after those world championships, I sustained a career-ending injury and I decided to move to the United States to start a PhD in sociology. And I happened to chance upon this topic and the very vast literature that's been written about it from the point of view of women's sports advocates who have examined at length the very many scientific and ethical dilemmas that surround the exclusion of women who have high testosterone. And initially, I was very confronted by this discovery, and it really was over time that my own view shifted. And I would say that something that was really critical in that process was meeting women who had high testosterone, becoming friends with women with high testosterone, and thinking about how they were personally impacted by these kinds of practices in sport.
This is a story, of course, about regulating women with naturally high testosterone levels. But it's also important to remember that this is also a story about one particular athlete and one particular woman, Caster Semenya. There is the issue of her sex in this, but there's also the issue of her race in this. Do you think that plays a factor in your view?
To be honest, I think those concerns are fair. I mean, I think there are questions to be answered about why Caster Semenya in particular has attracted this level of scrutiny and this level of determination on the part of the IAAF to exclude her from competing. Because when we compare her margin over her competitors to other successful athletes of this era, they enjoyed greater margins over their competitors. And yet for some reason we are fixated on Caster Semenya as the athlete whose margin of victory has become problematic for us. So I think it's a complicated issue, but I think it is very fair to be asking why women of colour from the Global South and from Sub-Saharan Africa in particular are overrepresented amongst the women who've been accused of having an unfair advantage.
And there is, of course, the issue of her sexuality. Semenya is a lesbian.
You know, when we think about why Semenya and why have her performances in particular raised the ire of a number of people, you have to wonder whether sexuality plays into it. I mean, she's openly a lesbian. She is, I would describe her as non-conforming in terms of her gender presentation. And I think the sport of track and field, as much as I love this sport and, you know, it's the number one love in my life, I think we have a little way to go still when it comes to accepting both diverse gender identities and also abandoning our ideas about heterosexuality.
The words fair and unfair get thrown around a lot in this conversation. What do people actually mean when they call something fair?
I think really what underlies a lot of people's motivations in this, you know, no matter which point of view you adhere to, people really want to see women's sport get stronger and be valued. And so what I look to for inspiration really on this topic is the leadership that we've seen from women's sports organizations like the Women's Sports Foundation here in the US, also the International Working Group on Women's Sport, activists like Billie Jean King, who have spoken out in support of Caster Semenya and who see Semenya's presence as a good thing for women's sport. So I follow their lead in saying that, you know, women's sport will benefit from Semenya being a part of it, and we have room to include her here.
That was Madeline Pape. She was an Olympic runner for Australia who once competed against Caster Semenya. Thank you so very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Esme Tran supports her family, including her 5-year-old daughter, by working as a maid in a Ho Chi Minh City hotel. Until one day, a wealthy American woman offers her an opportunity to go and live in California and accompany her son Kai, who is autistic and has never had a girlfriend, to all the family weddings that summer. Kai resists his mother's matchmaking, but, well, it wouldn't be much of a romance novel if they didn't begin to fall in love. Helen Wong is the author of The Bride Test, and she joins me now. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So tell me about Esme and Kai. How does that romance between them unfold?
So she gets invited to the United States by his mother, and his mother says to him that, you know, he has to let this woman live in his house for the summer, just the summer, so that he can hopefully develop a relationship or a connection with her. And while Esme is there, then she, of course, tries her hardest to seduce him. And it's awkward and really uncomfortable. And because he's on the spectrum, he's set in his ways. And she has some difficulties assimilating. So they both have to reach a compromise together and learn from each other.
Your last book, The Kiss Quotient, also featured an autistic main character. And you've said that through writing that story, you also came to realize your own autism at the age of 34. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So I'd been considering writing a gender-swapped pretty woman. But I didn't know why, a successful, beautiful woman would hire an escort. And I puzzled over this for a long time. And it was a meeting with my daughter's preschool teacher that really brought things together for me. She told me that she thought my daughter was on the autism spectrum. And that was very surprising for me because at that time I hadn't had much exposure to autism. But, you know, I came home and I kind of researched it, and it didn't seem right because my little girl is not, she didn't seem to be autistic from what I knew and what I saw, what I was reading online.
From your perceptions as her mom.
Yes. But then I was thinking about, you know, autism, and one of the big things they say is there's difficulty with social interaction. And that's something that I can really empathize with. And I thought, wouldn't that be an interesting reason to hire an escort? And so I started to research autism solely for the book. But as I researched, I ran into this very interesting thing where autism seems to display differently in women than in men. Women have learned to mask their autism, and they learn to copy their peers and
to mimic.
They learn to mimic, yes. And as I was reading, I was thinking about all the things that I do. You know, I tap my teeth, but I tap them because no one can see. Because if you move your fingers or you move your body or you rock in your chair, then people will see. And that's not good. It has to be secret. And there were so many things like that that I've done and that I've been hiding so unconsciously or subconsciously, I guess. And that kind of put me on this journey where I started to explore, could I be on the spectrum? And this all kind of happened as I was drafting this book. And the more I learned about myself, the better I could write this character. Her name is Stella. Mm. But then as I wrote Stella, I was learning about myself as I wrote her. So it was like this reciprocal process. That's how the diagnosis came to be and how the character came to be. We kind of happened at the same time.
What made you want to revisit having an autistic main character for this book?
There was this website I looked at. I don't want to tell you what it is because I don't want to drive traffic there. But basically they say that autistic people are heartless and that we don't experience empathy. We are selfish and cold. And anyone who's had a relationship could go on there and kind of air their grievances and say how horrible it was. And I'm sure that those situations exist, but I can't accept that that's a rule. So Kai, this character, was born from that injustice. I wanted to write a character and show how he may look cold, he may look heartless, and he might even think he's heartless, but he's not. And I wanted to show what that disconnect is and how different people experience emotions and process emotions in different ways. And it's not, there isn't a one right way.
Yeah, I read an interview where you said you were told you had a stone heart when you were younger.
Yes.
And that's actually a line that you give, Kai, in the book. That must have been a hard thing to hear.
Yes, it was exactly like I wrote it in the book. You know, I was walking home from school with my cousin, and I don't remember what we were talking about, but it came up that I had a stone heart because nothing bothered me, and I didn't care about anything, and I didn't have feelings. And it's really stuck with me because I thought, well, that's not true. I do have feelings. I don't act like everyone else, but it's there. I can feel them sometimes. Mm. Sometimes it gets too much and it's confusing. Or when the emotions get too big, then I feel that I will shut down. And then I need time, I think.
There are, as you know, so many people who are autistic, and there is such a wide spectrum of how people experience that. But very few stories that show them sort of living and loving and succeeding. And your book changes that. Why is it important to tell that story for you?
Well, I think it's important for these characters, me. Personally, I want to believe that I can be a main character, I can be a leading character in my life, that I can have a happily ever after, that I can find true love and I can get married and conquer and be happy. And I think one thing for my books is, yes, my characters have the sexual intimacy. And I think that's also important to show autistic people can have these very full lives and experience things that regular people do. I sometimes run into people who find my portrayal to be offensive and insensitive.
Really?
By giving people normal lives, which is, it kind of breaks my heart every time I hear that, because I'm married. I have kids. My husband loves me as a woman. I am a woman, and I have the same needs and desires as anybody else.
Helen Wong is the author of The Bride Test. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Psychedelic mushrooms were federally banned back in the 70s, but a growing movement wants access to them, mostly for medicinal use. In Denver, Esther Honig of Harvest Public Media reports that mushroom enthusiasts want the freedom to take them without fear of criminal prosecution.
Euphoria, hallucinations, seeing God are all side effects of psilocybin mushrooms, which people consume sometimes in a tea, as a chocolate, or in tiny doses, also called microdosing. And these mushrooms grow all over the world.
These right here, I picked like 3 days ago.
They can even grow in this storage closet in a Denver apartment. Douglas, who didn't want to use his full name for fear of federal prosecution, holds a handful of mushrooms that he cultivates and sells illegally.
Mushrooms are really easygoing, especially psilocybin. You know, they kind of just grow themselves, and like this is a relatively quiet thing to do.
With his DIY setup of glass jars, large plastic bins, and a pressure cooker, Douglas can grow up to $1,000 of mushrooms per month. He learned how on the internet and bought his first mushroom spores from an online seller, which is legal in all but two U.S. states.
If you just want to start small, investment's super low. You could throw $80 at it and have, like, an ounce to yourself.
But doing so could land you in prison, which is why a ballot measure in Denver's Tuesday election asks voters to decriminalize mushrooms. Adults 21 or older caught using or even growing the fungi for themselves would become a low priority for local police. It'd still be illegal to sell them, but Douglas says it'll be good for business.
With decriminalization and stuff, I can operate a little bit more freely. Have to worry less.
And it's not just Denver. A Republican lawmaker in Iowa recently proposed removing psilocybin from the state's list of controlled substances. And in Oregon, a campaign hopes to legalize it for medical use in approved clinics.
This isn't the stuff that states have any infrastructure to deal with.
Matthew Johnson has spent the last 15 years researching psychedelics at Johns Hopkins University. He says research shows this drug is not addictive and could be used to treat a whole host of ailments, like depression. But he doesn't support increasing access in the same way some states have loosened up laws around cannabis.
There are substantial risks involved with this therapy, and it needs to be done by appropriately trained and credentialed medical and psychological professionals.
Under the influence of psilocybin, people can panic and put themselves in danger. There have been fatalities. In as little as 5 years, Johnson believes research on psilocybin will lead to the first FDA-approved medication, at which point the federal government will have to stop treating it like a dangerous drug. But until then,
any controlled substance is a concern. It's obviously on a Schedule 1 for a reason.
Deanne Reuter is with the DA office in Denver and says they'll continue prosecuting psilocybin cases, even though they don't see that many.
The trafficking of psilocybin seems to be like a small niche kind of community.
If the ballot measure passes, Reuter expects dealers like Douglas will exploit the decriminalization, and what is now a small market could grow. For NPR News, I'm Esther Honig.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Sharon Brody in Boston. Another Massachusetts community has decided to ban polystyrene. At Arlington's annual town meeting last week, residents approved the ban on all polystyrene products, including styrofoam. The Arlington Advocate reports the ban will take effect at the beginning of next year. Conservationists on Cape Cod say they have found a humpback whale carcass on a sandbar north of Provincetown. The Center for Coastal Studies tells the Cape Cod Times the female whale was found yesterday on Stellwagen Bank. The cause of death has not been determined. The state's Division of Marine Fisheries is supporting a bill to overhaul Massachusetts lobster laws. The proposal would change processing regulations for fresh and frozen lobster inside the shell. Those categories currently are exported from the state for processing. In the forecast, some rain today, some patchy fog, and temperatures in the low 50s. It's 51 degrees now. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston University College of Fine Arts, a beacon for the arts in Boston and beyond. Learn more at bu.edu/CFA. Commonwealth Learning Center. One-to-one multisensory instruction for students with learning challenges. commlearn.com. Learning differently. Teaching differently. Succeeding. And Fairbank and Perry Goldsmiths in Concord. Working closely with clients to create original custom engagement and wedding rings. On Instagram at Fairbank and Perry.
Venezuela's future remains in doubt. We'll hear the latest on the power struggle there. I'm Arthi Shahani. Also, how the country's crisis has affected one of its young musicians.
I feel like there's no Venezuelan that doesn't know depression, doesn't know oppression.
Lolita de Sola on what life in her country has become. That's next time on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 5 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, or German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, BABBEL.com. And from C3, C3's AI software suite enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale to solve previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at c3.ai.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Rachel Held Evans has died. She was a best-selling author on matters of faith and an advocate for a number of progressive issues. She'd been hospitalized for the flu but suffered an allergic reaction to antibiotics. After her death yesterday, her husband Dan wrote, "Rachel's presence in this world was a gift to us all, and her work will long survive her." She was 37. Sarah Bessie is a fellow writer and a friend of Rachel Held Evans, and she joins us now. I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you very much. It has felt surreal, like it's some nightmare we'll wake up from here soon. It just hardly feels like it's possible.
Tell me a little bit about your friend who also happened to be a leader in what's called the Christian left.
Rachel is remarkable. she was fearless and was just very passionate about justice, and we regularly just marveled at her capacity and her intellect. One of the things that I have always loved about Rachel in all the years that we have been friends is that she always was someone who put what was right and what was true and what was good ahead of her own self-interest, even when it was, jarring, I think, to people. Over and over in these last few days, I just have heard over and over about how relentlessly she championed the voices and experiences of people who often were ignored or marginalized in the church and just kept resetting it. She was generous and loving and, God, just so supportive. I mean, and she was such a good mom and a good wife, a good sister, good friend to so many of us.
And she also had a large following in the evangelical community in both progressive and conservative circles, which is remarkable in these times.
Yeah, it is. It really is. I mean, I think that that was part of what Rachel did so incredibly well was she honored where she came from. She loved it. I think that's part of the reason why she pushed so hard at wanting it to do better. But even beyond all of that, she said what people were longing for, what they were hoping for, what they were thinking or feeling. She asked the questions out loud that the rest of us had been told to keep in the dark. And she connected people to this beautiful vision of the gospel that was just so loving and good and whole and filled with peace and room. I'm so grateful.
Rachel went to Bryan College in Tennessee, and they teach a literal interpretation of the Bible there. And she'd also been a member of an evangelical church, but she left it to become an Episcopalian. Can you illuminate her journey a little bit, how she moved from one side to another?
Well, Rachel never did anything by half. Anything she did was with her whole heart. It was a big change. But honestly, her hunger for God, her sense of justice and fairness, her curiosity really was the thing that led her on that path, her huge heart for people. It's an incredible journey, but it's one that she left as a trail for the rest of us to follow when we found ourselves in that place of saying, I don't know if I believe this anymore, or what does this mean politically, or what does this mean for my neighbors?
What do you think her legacy should be?
You know, I feel like I can't even begin to imagine what all of her work that she has done will end up meaning for the world. I feel like Rachel was in many ways a pioneer and a groundbreaker for us long before most of our churches and spaces were talking about things like Me Too or abuse. She was pushing into that space, and she was illuminating it and writing about it and celebrating people who were pushing up against, you know, darkness in all of these places. That she was someone who pushed so hard into full LGBTQ inclusion in the church. She was an accomplice and an ally. And to me, I feel like her legacy will be that work that she did that laid a path for the rest of us to follow, that would be a more full vision of what the kingdom of God actually looks like.
That's Sarah Bessie via Skype, remembering her friend Rachel Held Evans. Thank you very much, and my deepest condolences.
Thank you, Lulu. I appreciate that.
It's commencement season, a time for stories of proud people tossing their caps in the air, people like Michaela LeCompte. She's graduating this weekend from Montana State University. It's her third time trying for a college degree, and she got it as a 29-year-old single mom with three little kids. She joins us now from Billings. Welcome to the program, and congratulations.
Thank you, Lulu.
I wanted to talk to you after seeing your story in the Billings Gazette because, you know, we often gloss over the details of the single mom goes back to school stories. Definitely. And the details are still so fresh for you. So let's start with your story. You first started trying to go to college in 2008, right after getting your GED. What happened?
I went to a college that had very large classes, and I realized, whoa, like there's something more wrong with me than I thought. And I wasn't passing any classes, so it just did not work out.
What did you realize was challenging you?
Well, I couldn't stay focused. And, you know, when you get that label when you're a child, like you have attention deficit disorder. And back then I didn't really know anybody with learning disabilities in college. And so I just felt like this is, you know, jumping into the deep end. Mm-hmm. I didn't like that I couldn't engage with professors, like, because that's how I grew up barely making it, was just really get the teachers laughing so they wouldn't be upset that I didn't understand what they were talking about.
So in the summer of 2015, when you decided it was time to go back to college for the third time, it must have been really hard having children and going to school.
It was. I have a lot of people who say that too, like who are traditional students, and they're saying, you know, I could barely do this as a traditional student. How are you doing this? And I said, you know, I wouldn't have been as successful if I did not have those three little people looking at me. Like setting that example was even more important. Mm. And so I had to really figure out how to really help their needs emotionally and still go to school. I don't know how many times I had to write a paper with one of my children on my lap crying because they want more attention from me. And I'm desperately trying to focus on this paper to get it done, or this math equation. And here my children are like, no, mom.
You had a model for this, though. Your parents were teen parents, and your mom actually went back to school when you were a kid.
Yes, she did. And my dad was always right there rooting her on, like, look at her, look at what she's doing, like that example for you guys. And we're like, yes, we see it, we see you. And even though I had struggles as a single parent and somebody with a learning disability, I knew there's still a way. I just didn't know what that way was.
There are a lot of non-traditional college students like you, a lot of parents thinking about going back to school. What would you want them to know?
When I meet those people, because I meet them often, and they're in my own life, I have many friends who say, well, this, my child is this, or the funds. I can't even, I'm a poor single parent, or I'm just poor in general. And that would be my message to them, is do not let that label define what we can accomplish. And utilize their resources that are provided for you. Because as soon as I opened that door to those resources, it changed up the whole game for me. Because I realized there was on campus a team that would fight for me. In Indian country, we're very proud people. So it's really hard to say, hey, help me. Don't be afraid to ask for that help.
What does your graduation mean for your family?
To my family, it means... We all gravitate towards jobs of helping people. We're public servants. My sister's a first grade teacher in a Title I school. She gets emotional saying, you are proof that the children that I teach have that chance. That even though they are poor, or that they are a minority, or that they have a learning disability, that they can make it. The work really does pay off.
And what do you plan to do now that you graduated?
I want to go into the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Currently, we only have one person to talk to when it comes to public relations for all of our reservations in the United States. But the thing people don't understand is that we're all so different. All of our tribes, we just believe in different things. And it's not even a position that I could even give a title. But even if that means I'm just like... pushing paper and making copies, just slowly make my way up.
That's Michaela LeCompte. She graduates from Montana State University this weekend, cum laude, with a degree in public relations. Thank you so much, and congratulations again.
Thank you.
Around 1985, Danita Sparks met Susie Gardner, and they had an idea. They both lived in Echo Park, Los Angeles, and they both played the guitar, something they saw few women do back then. They also wanted to write and sing, another unusual thing for that time. So they started a band, a punk rock band. Along with Jennifer Finch and Dee Plakas, they called themselves L7. Here is Sparks.
I personally did not want anybody to be able to tell if we were male or female. So we just thought L7 was kind of mysterious, ambiguous.
L7 took off and Sparks became one of the greatest female electric guitar players. Her instrument, the Flying V.
A Flying V, a lot of guitars are very curvy, kind of like the silhouette of a... va-va-va-voom woman, and a Flying V is very angular, and it looks like you're playing something from the Jetsons. When we first started out, people really didn't know how to react. There were a lot of just like staring at us like, wow, what are these people doing? Are they, is this irony? Is this real? You know, they look so rough around the edges, but as time went on, people were just going completely wild and a lot of crowd participation.
America, get ready for the most dangerous women in the country. We are L7!
When we finally got roadies, who were just really our friends, they would be fending off the audience. There was no stage. We would just be playing on the floor where the audience was, and it was just mayhem. And, you know, we would really have to stand firm because our microphones were always getting knocked around and our pedals were getting stomped on and turned off and unplugged. It was mayhem, but it was really fun mayhem.
There are a lot of women in the audience tonight, so...
So while you're doing your thing in the pit, please be considerate of them. That's all we're asking, okay?
Oh, we would stop the shows all the time, and we would have people ejected. And there's one live tape of me going like, okay, the bloody guy's got to go. You know, security, the bloody guy's got to go. In 2001, the wheels fell off. We had no money. Grunge was waning. Our popularity was waning. There were new bands coming up. We got rid of our manager. Our record label dropped us. You know, it's that thing that happens towards the end of a band's life. But I was calling it an indefinite hiatus because I didn't quite think that we were maybe finished yet. I was checking out stuff online about L7 and there was nothing. It was almost like we didn't exist. And yet I saw these Facebook pages start to pop up with fans posting content. And I was kind of like, well, I've got better stuff than that. I've got the better shot from that. I've got the outtake. So I started archiving my stuff and posting it onto our own Facebook page, not thinking that we were going to be a band again, but just like honoring our 20-year-old selves. And then it just blew up, and we were seeing all kinds of comments. First, it was just, reunite, reunite. And then, you know, people missed us. People missed our voice. People missed bands being feisty. We didn't know we had all these fans still that wanted us to come back. Well, in 2015, we decided to do some shows, and we thought, you know, we can't wait too long if we're going to do this. Are we all interested in this? I put it out to everybody, and everybody came back and said, yeah, let's do it. We had been a bit estranged, and now here we are putting out a new record, and it's called Scatter the Rats. Coming back and doing these shows has felt like a victory lap in a way, because it ended so crappy and with bad feelings towards each other and stuff. And now it feels like, okay, when we're ready to end this, we'll end it together. I mean, hopefully that's the way it'll be. But connecting with our fans again, who are just so lovely and so crazy and such freakazoids, and hearing their stories about how we kind of helped them get through being teenagers. It's amazing. It's like, it's pinch me moments every night. So right now it's just like being grateful for every time we walk out on stage, you know, and that we're healthy enough to do it.
Danita Sparks of the band L7, their latest album is Scatter the Rats.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Ramadan Mubarak for those observing the holy month. Happy Sunday. Thanks for listening. I'm Lulu Garcia Navarro.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Noom, offering a personalized weight loss program that uses psychology and small goals to change habits with the goal of losing weight and keeping it off for good. Learn more at Noom, NOOM.com. From the NPR Wine Club, where every bottle tells a story, and favorite NPR shows become exclusive wines like Weekend Edition Primitivo, available to adults 21 years or older. NPRWineClub.org. And from Americans for the Arts.
This is 90.9 WBUR. It is 50 degrees in Boston, coming up on 10 o'clock as Weekend Edition continues.
WBUR supporters include Jewish Arts Collaborative, with Broadway to Bluegrass, Songwriters to Sonatas, at Bernstein Reimagined, May 16th at Berkeley Performance Center, jartsboston.org. Good News Garage, a local New England nonprofit moving neighbors in need towards self-sufficiency with donated cars, vans, and trucks. GoodNewsGarage.org. And Mass Art Continuing Ed, supporting your artistic and professional development with classes in fine art and design. Enrolling now for summer, massart.edu.
Hi, it's Robin Young. There is no substitute for your mom, and there's no substitute for WBUR. So, this Mother's Day, warm your mom's heart with Winston flowers and support your favorite radio station. We'll deliver your gift anywhere in the country. Order now to save 10%. Call 1-800-909-9287 or see the choices and order yours at WBUR.org.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston,
92.7 WBUA Tisbury,
89.1 WBUH Brewster,
streaming at WBUR.org,
and live at City Space, Boston's new home for public conversation.
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Good morning. Rocket fire and airstrikes. Conflict flares again in the Middle East. There have been deaths and injuries in Israel and the Gaza Strip. Here at home, a booming economy, but questions about how the president engages with Russia. We'll get reports from the economically and politically intertwined Cuba and Venezuela as well. And in our series on how we are adapting to climate change, we visit a dolphin pod at the National Aquarium. Plus, Cuban-American rapper Pitbull is a megastar, and he opens up about what he learned about entrepreneurship from watching drug dealers in Miami. It's Sunday, May 5th, Cinco de Mayo. News now.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. Another round of spring flooding appears to be a possibility. Forecasters say rainfall expected this week could lead to more flooding along the Mississippi River and its tributaries, just as water levels drop after reaching their highest levels ever at some places. Greg Galina is a National Weather Service meteorologist.
Currently, we have very major flooding along the Mississippi and Missouri River basins in the main stem rivers, but the tributaries are kind of running a little bit lower right now. But this amount of rain, the 3 to 5 additional inches of rain through the beginning of the week, should actually increase those tributaries to potentially flooding and then add into the ongoing flooding in the area.
Spring flooding in Davenport, Iowa last week broke a record set back in 1993. Scientology cruise ship Free Winds docked at its home port in Curaçao Saturday, but it's unclear how many passengers are being allowed to disembark. NPR's Ryan Bink reports a vessel arrived days after it was quarantined by officials in nearby St. Lucia because a crew member contracted measles.
Curaçao health officials say passengers who can prove they're vaccinated or have had the disease in the past will likely be allowed on dry land. Others will remain aboard for the duration of the measles incubation period, which is between 10 and 12 days. Dr. Izzy Gerson-Bluth is the chief epidemiologist for Curaçao Biomedical and Health Research Institute. He says the infected person traveled in Europe before she
joined the ship as a crew member and a couple of days later started having a runny nose, and the ship's doctor decided to isolate her.
Gerstenbluth says a small team is aboard the ship administering vaccines. He adds the process could take some time. Ryan Bank, NPR News.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered the military to keep up airstrikes and tank fire against militants in Gaza as hostilities stretch into a third day. The Israeli army says more than 400 mortars and rockets have been fired into Israeli territory from Gaza, leading to the death of an Israeli man. Several Palestinians have been killed. To Venezuela now, where authorities say they are carrying out an investigation after a military helicopter crashed into a mountain. NPR's Philip Reeves says 7 Venezuelan military officers were killed.
2 lieutenant colonels were among the Venezuelan military personnel killed. Officials say their helicopter went down on its way to Cojedes. That's a state southwest of Caracas. President Nicolas Maduro was in that same state yesterday, appearing on government-run TV at a military academy there to try to show his armed forces are still loyal. He was doing so after the US-backed opposition leader Juan Guaido tried to exploit dissent within Venezuela's armed forces by triggering a military uprising to drive Maduro from power. In a tweet, Maduro expressed condolences to the crash victims. Philip Reeves, NPR News, Caracas.
And you're listening to NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Sharon Brody in Boston. The state's Department of Transportation says westbound exit 17 off the Mass Pike will be closed starting this hour for today's annual Walk for Hunger. Some 10,000 people are expected to walk one of three routes today to raise money for area food pantries. The Newton exit of the Pike will be closed until 5 p.m. today. Tomorrow is the last day of operations for a popular Irish bar in Brighton. The Greenbrier Pub is closing after nearly 30 years. In January, Maine will become the first state to ban the use of most polystyrene, including styrofoam. The Natural Resources Council of Maine is praising the new law. Executive Director Lisa Pohlman says styrofoam products cannot be recycled economically, and the law will help reduce litter.
It's thrilling to be the first state in the nation to ban this, you know, in the food sector for, plastic foam, because we've got to get on top of these kinds of single-use plastics.
The ban will end use of more than 256 million pieces of disposable foam cups, plates, bowls, platters, and trays now discarded every year in Maine. The measure only allows the use of styrofoam containers by hospitals and Meals on Wheels programs. Conservationists on Cape Cod say they have found a humpback whale carcass on a sandbar north of Provincetown. The Center for Coastal Studies tells the Cape Cod Times the female whale was found yesterday on Stillwagon Bank. The cause of death has not been determined. In sports, the Bruins lead the playoff series against the Blue Jackets 3-2. Last night at the Garden, the Bees won 4-3. Last night, the Red Sox beat the White Sox 15-2. They play again this afternoon in Chicago. Last night, the Revs lost to Philadelphia 6-1. Rain around Boston today, some patchy fog and temperatures in the low 50s. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Next Generation. Performed by Boston Ballet 2 and Boston Ballet School with the Boston Philharmonic Youth Orchestra, May 22nd. Get tickets at bostonballet.org. Boston University's Graduate Tax Program. Advance your career with an LLM or master's degree in tax law. Open to tax, legal, and business professionals. And Frederica and Howard Stevenson, supporting Olin College, which is working to help the next generation of engineers develop the entrepreneurial skills, experience, and mindset to bring technological innovations to market. Learn more at olin.edu.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Good morning. We begin this morning in the Middle East, where there is a second day of conflict. Militants in the Gaza Strip have fired another huge barrage of rockets at Israel. In response, the Israeli Air Force has launched airstrikes inside Gaza at militant targets. There are reports of casualties on both sides. Reporter Naomi Zevaloff joins us now from Tel Aviv. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Naomi, what's been happening?
This morning, I spoke with an Israeli army spokesman who was briefing journalists to say that Gaza militants had launched hundreds of rockets at Israel and that Israel responded by striking hundreds of military targets. The spokesman also told me that the army was planning to deploy an armored brigade to be ready for an offensive mission if needed. And there have been casualties on both sides. The military spokesman said that a rocket from Gaza killed one Israeli man. And I also just got off the phone with the Barzilai Medical Center in Ashkelon, where I was told that two other Israeli civilians just died from rocket fire from Gaza. And the Gaza Ministry of Health is also reporting that Israeli airstrikes have killed multiple people. Two of those people were claimed as militants by a group called Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Among the victims were a pregnant woman and a 14-month-old baby in Gaza, but there are conflicting accounts over what happened to them. Gaza health officials say an Israeli airstrike killed them, but the Israeli military spokesman I talked to said that rocket fire by Palestinians that landed inside the Gaza Strip is what killed them.
What is behind this latest flare-up?
Well, for more than a year, there have been clashes and protests at the site of the Gaza fence. Palestinians in Gaza have launched what's called the March of Return, which is meant to highlight the Palestinian call to return to their historic homelands, which are now a part of Israel. And many times over the past year, the situation at the fence has escalated into rockets and airstrikes. But this specific escalation, the army in Israel pins on an event on Friday when militants shot and injured two soldiers, and Israel retaliated with an airstrike that killed two militants, and then rockets were shot from Gaza, and here we are today.
Yeah. What do we know about Israel's plans? Could we see this escalate?
Well, as I said, Israel is certainly prepared to possibly deploy that armored brigade for an offensive mission. And, you know, this Israeli strikes are continuing and rockets are also continuing right now. And this is a quite an escalation between the two sides and really a serious one since the 2014 war. That was a war that lasted many weeks. Dozens of Israeli soldiers and several Israeli civilians died. And on the Palestinian side, more than 2,000 people died, including many civilians and also militants.
With the stakes so high, are there negotiations for a ceasefire, do you know? And can you tell us about those and where they stand?
Well, before this current outbreak of violence, Egypt was mediating between the two sides to prevent such hostilities from returning. And those negotiations were meant to exchange calm on the border for Israel lifting certain restrictions in the Gaza Strip, basically to make life more bearable for people in Gaza. And this conflict certainly puts those negotiations at serious risk.
That's reporter Naomi Zeveloff in Tel Aviv. Naomi, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here at home, the economy is booming, so why not take another crack at Infrastructure Week?
We just had a very productive meeting with the President of the United States.
That's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi Tuesday. Democratic leaders and President Trump agreed to spend $2 trillion, that's a number the president suggested, on roads and bridges and more. But Senate Republicans and reportedly even Trump's own chief of staff expressed skepticism immediately. Oh, and then all the talk was about Russia again. NPR political correspondent Mara Liasson is with us this morning. Hi, Mara.
Hi, Lulu.
All right. So the president says he's still looking hard at an infrastructure plan, though he's dialing the price tag down to $1 to $2 trillion. What odds do you give it?
I give it slim odds. Here, as you said, he immediately got pushback from his own chief of staff, from Republicans in the Senate, including the Republican leader, Mitch McConnell. They think that's too much money. They certainly don't want to raise the gas tax to pay for it. And it's just another example of how the president is having trouble working the levers of his own government. He couldn't get his own Homeland Security Department to do what he wanted them to do at the border. And if he can't make a deal with Mick Mulvaney, the chief of staff, and Mitch McConnell, he's certainly not going to be able to make one with Nancy Pelosi.
Mara, we should say at this point that the president got some impressive economic numbers this week, record low unemployment for one. So are Democratic leaders maybe rethinking the wisdom of handing him another possible win on infrastructure?
Well, the politics of infrastructure is a little unclear. Who needs an infrastructure bill more, Trump or the Democrats in Congress? Democrats presumably would want to show what they would do if they were in control of the government. Donald Trump wants to show that he can pass some kind of legislation. So the politics of that are unclear, but the bottom line is America's roads and bridges are crumbling and nothing is happening about it in Washington.
Let's look abroad. There's fighting in Gaza, as you heard, with presidential son-in-law Jared Kushner's peace plan still in the works. There's Venezuela, North Korea, a lot.
A lot. And just as the president has been frustrated in getting his domestic priorities passed, he also hasn't seen his foreign policy agenda work out the way he wanted to. In Venezuela, Maduro is still there. North Korea just fired several short-range projectiles into the sea. And back to Russia, the president had an hour-long call with Vladimir Putin, and it almost was back to Helsinki because the president said he did not raise Russian interference in the 2016 election. He did not warn Russia not to meddle in the 2020 election, even though his own intelligence community says that the Russians have never given up trying. So another place where he's a party of one at odds with his own government.
President Trump's line is that it's better to be, quote, getting along, unquote, with Russia, right?
Yes, and certainly everybody would agree it's good to get along with countries around the world. The problem is that everyone else in the Trump administration acknowledges that Russia interfered in the 2016 election, except for the president. The Mueller report said Russia interfered in a, quote, sweeping and systematic fashion. The president has never consistently acknowledged that, except for when he's blaming President Obama for doing nothing about it. And the question is that because he's so insecure about his election, he doesn't want to talk about anything that seems to undermine his legitimacy? Or is it because he's fine with Russia doing it again in 2020 on his behalf? After all, his own lawyer said recently on CNN, quote, there's nothing wrong with taking information from the Russians. That was Rudy Giuliani. And, you know, you saw the president take Putin's line on Venezuela. After the phone call, he said Russia is not looking to get involved in Venezuela. That directly contradicts his own Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, who've said Russia not only is involved in Venezuela, it's working in defiance of the U.S. government. And Secretary Pompeo said the Russians have invaded Venezuela.
That's NPR's Mara Liasson. Mara, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, so what happened at the Kentucky Derby? Maximum Security was the favorite to win, so it was no surprise that the thoroughbred claimed an early lead going into the first turn and held on to it. But then officials announced an objection, and the race results were labeled as unofficial. The objection held, pushing Maximum Security back to 17th place and handing the win to a long-shot colt named Country House. That resulted in the second highest payout in Derby history. Joining us now from member station WFPL in Louisville is reporter Ryan Van Velter. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. So how did it feel in those moments after the race? Take us there.
Picture this. There are about 150,000 people at Churchill Downs rooting for this race, plus millions more watching at home. But from the vantage point of the people in the stands, all they see are the pink silks of Maximum Security's jockey pulling out ahead and crossing the finish line on a muddy track. So first, there was cheering. I mean, Maximum Security was the favorite to win, and a lot of people were betting on that horse. Then there was 20 minutes of confusion. You have the objection. You have these unofficial results on the board saying that Maximum Security won. You have people trying to cash in their tickets at the betting windows. Other people are leaving, not knowing who won. And in the press room, we were just sitting there stunned, waiting for the official call.
Why did racing officials disqualify Maximum Security?
Yeah, so in the final bend, Maximum Security drifted wide into another horse's lane. That caused a domino effect, disrupting the progress of three other horses. Country House's jockey, Flavian Pratt, was the one who filed the objection after the race. So three stewards, which are basically like referees, reviewed the footage and interviewed the affected jockeys. Eventually, steward Barbara Borden gave a brief statement saying that they unanimously decided to disqualify Maximum Security, then walked away without taking any questions.
Wow, it sounds like a political conference. All right, has anything like this ever happened before?
So one other horse was stripped of his title after the fact. That was because he essentially failed a drug test back in 1968. But no, this was a first. And the outcome of this year's Derby was just so unpredictable. The original horse couldn't even compete. And the second favorite, Maximum Security, lost even though he crossed the finish line first.
All right. So give us the story with Country House briefly. His trainer is named Bill Mott. Did you hear from him?
Yeah. So Country House is a chestnut colt bred in Kentucky. He was a long shot with 65-1 odds of winning ahead of the race. The payout for his winning ticket was $132.40. That's the second highest in Derby history. He started out the race slow, but picked up momentum throughout. He definitely saw his opportunity going into that last turn, and he took it. In a press conference after the announcement, Mott himself said he was a little bit surprised to see how well the horse was doing. He called the victory bittersweet and said it's not how he wanted to win, but he knows it's a race that will be remembered for years to come.
So I can't imagine this is done. Is there any chance for an appeal?
There is. It's possible that the trainers or the owners could file an appeal with the Kentucky Horse Racing Commission. And in the meantime, Country House has a chance at the second jewel in the Triple Crown at the Preakness Stakes later this month.
That's Ryan Van Velter of member station WFPL in Louisville. Ryan, thank you.
Thank you.
Send Winston flowers through WBUR for Mother's Day and support the station you rely on. Order now and save 10% at WBUR.org.
It is 50 degrees in Boston at 10:18. Ahead on Weekend Edition Sunday, you'll consider a federal judge's decision to release a man convicted of plotting an attack on New York City's subway. That and more coming up on Weekend Edition. Rain around today in Boston, some fog as well, and temperatures in the low 50s. This is 90.9 WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Innuendo. With smartphone-controlled Hunter Douglas PowerView motorized shades in their window fashions gallery. Hunter Douglas at Innuendo Natick and Innuendo.com. Tufts Medical Center, who believes great care should anticipate patient needs. That's why they always think ahead. Information at TuftsMedicalCenter.org/thinking. And Boston Lyric Opera, presenting Reuters' The Handmaid's Tale, based on Margaret Atwood's extraordinary novel, Sunday through May 12th. Tickets at BLO.org.
I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. State media in North Korea say leader Kim Jong-un oversaw a live fire drill this weekend, testing what it said were large-calibered, long-range rocket launchers and tactical guided weapons. The report today came after South Korea's military said the North launched several unidentified short-range projectiles into the Sea of Japan on Saturday. Hostilities between Israel and Palestinian militants in Gaza have stretched into a third day. The Israeli military says more than 400 rockets have been fired into Israeli territory, prompting retaliatory airstrikes and tank fire. And Pope Francis is in the Balkans. He arrived in Bulgaria today on a trip that will also take him to neighboring North Macedonia, where voters today are casting ballots in a runoff election for president. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org. From the Craig Newmark Foundation, committed to the values of fairness, opportunity, and respect, the Newmark Foundation supports veterans and military families, voting rights, truth and journalism, and women in tech. And from Americans for the Arts.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Lulu Garcia Navarro. Uncertainty over the fate of Venezuela is steadily growing deeper. A few days ago, it looked as if President Nicolas Maduro was about to fall. Opposition leader Juan Guaido tried to trigger a military uprising with the support of his closest ally, the United States. It failed. The leaders of Venezuela's military stuck by Maduro. U.S. officials are trying to figure out what went wrong. And as NPR's Philip Reeves reports, they're blaming Cuba.
No one disputes there are Cubans in Venezuela. There is dispute, though, about what they're up to. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton says they're Cuban security forces. He says there are at least 20,000 of them. Cuba says that's nonsense.
There is no Cuban participation in any sort of military or security operations in Venezuela.
Johanna Tablada is Deputy Director of U.S. Affairs in Cuba's Foreign Ministry. She doesn't really argue with Bolton's number of roughly 20,000, but says they're civilians.
Most of them are medical personnel. They do perform a very noble work that is a health work, that is a humanitarian work. They are also teachers.
Supporters of Juan Guaido have long complained about the influence wielded by Cubans in Venezuela.
They are the real power in Venezuela right now.
Economist Jose Torojadi believes were it not for the Cubans, Venezuela's generals would by now have abandoned Maduro.
I don't think they believe anymore in the Maduro's government, but I believe they are very afraid because they know Cuban intelligence is watching over their shoulders all the time.
President Trump seems to agree. The U.S. is tightening sanctions and threatening a full embargo on Cuba unless it pulls all of its forces out of Venezuela. If you ask Venezuelans for details about who these Cubans are and what they do, the reply is often vague. We've come to meet a retired Venezuelan colonel who says he has first-hand experience of Cuba's role. He's called Jesus, but doesn't want his full name broadcast for fear of reprisals. We meet inside a parking garage to avoid being seen. Jesus says during his 30-year career in Venezuela's National Guard, he often came across Cubans embedded within the ranks.
They slept in our National Guard barracks. They went running at dawn with us. That's why I say I've seen them inside Venezuela's armed forces.
Colonel Jesus says he's not sure whether these Cubans were actually military officials, nor does he know how many there were. He is sure, though, that they weren't doctors or teachers.
What we did know was that they were Cuban government officials.
The colonel says two Cuban officials took a particular interest in him. He suspects they were trying to recruit him as an informer.
I felt that they were spying on me and on my family. I was suspicious because they were trying so hard to be friendly, even though I showed no warmth towards them.
No Venezuelan soldier had any doubt about what would happen if the Cubans found evidence of disloyalty, says the colonel.
The first thing they would do is imprison him. There are countless soldiers locked up because of the information these Cuban elements have passed along to the Maduro dictatorship and Cuba's government.
When Juan Guaido's call for a military uprising failed last week, the colonel was disappointed, but not surprised. He believes the campaign to get rid of Maduro and the Cubans, who he says prop him up, requires more time. Even then, there's no guarantee it'll succeed. Philip Reeves, NPR News, Caracas.
And now let's go to Cuba and NPR's Carrie Kahn. She's in Havana. Hi, Carrie.
Hi.
So, tough new sanctions to try and induce Havana to withdraw its support of Maduro. What are those sanctions and what kind of effect are you seeing there?
Top of the list of the sanction is that Americans can now sue foreign companies in Cuba that they say are profiting or using their properties that were seized during the Cuban Revolution. And we've already seen a couple lawsuits being filed in Miami about that. What the Trump administration is hoping is that will scare away foreign investment from Cuba. And they've also targeted the amount of money that people from abroad, family members, can send to Cubans in Cuba. They've limited that to $1,000 every 3 months. That's a drastic cut in the remittances, the money family members send back to Cubans. And they've also cut visas, too. It used to be you could get a 5-year visa to go in and out of the United States. Now they've limited that to 3 months.
Cuba and Venezuela are very closely linked economically, in addition to ideologically and politically. So is the deterioration in Venezuela of the economy affecting Cuba?
I think what to look at closely is oil and oil here on the island. Cuba is not able to meet its own energy demands by itself and has become very dependent for the last 20 years on Venezuela's cheap oil that they're sending to Cuba. What they've done is made an exchange where Cuba gets the oil that it needs and then Cuba sends doctors and professionals to Venezuela. And that has been severely hurt by the economic crisis in Venezuela right now. And you see that in there's gas rationing right now, and the Cuban government trying to get as much as they can in dollars and foreign currency. One thing that they've done, you know, those classic U.S. American cars that are still here on the island, where those taxi drivers are feeling the pinch of the gas shortages and the oil situation right now. They have to pay very high licenses. This is new only in the last couple months, and they have gas rationing cards that they can only buy a certain amount of gasoline every month.
And Raul Castro has actually come out and warned that hard, austere times are coming. Are Cubans concerned about what they might be facing?
Definitely. And you hear that a lot. He did. That was quite an interesting public declaration for Raul to come out and say that. And he said it's not going to be as bad as after the collapse of the Soviet Union, what they called the special period, where Cuba saw a lot of food shortages and a lot of blackouts and energy problems at the time. But he is warning that more austere times are coming. And you hear that from people because there are huge lines right now. People are waiting hours in lines to get basic foodstuffs. There's shortages of chicken, shortages of cooking oil. People are just very worried about their future right now.
That's NPR's Carrie Kahn in Havana. Thank you so much, Carrie.
You're welcome.
And tomorrow on Morning Edition, a new bill in Texas that LGBTQ activists warn could open up new avenues for discrimination, but that legislators say is meant to protect religious liberty. Listen tomorrow by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. In our ongoing series on how the East Coast is adapting to climate change, we traveled this past week to the National Aquarium in Baltimore. This institution is facing multiple climate change-related challenges, both outside and inside the building. Yes, I'm at the Dolphin Show, but it's changed over the years. There's no disco music, no synchronized jumping. It's mostly educational now.
Dolphins need to be physically fit, just like us. How do we accomplish that goal? Exercise.
Then Dr. Lee Clayton introduces me to the Atlantic Bottlenose Pod.
Jade is the mom of Foster, who's one of our males. And then Chesapeake in spirit and mind.
She's the head of animal care and welfare at the aquarium. And she says they've decided to relocate the pod to give them a better life outside in their native habitat. The dolphins will still be in a controlled environment, but one that is better for them.
It really kind of takes the pressure off of us to create intellectually stimulating and physically stimulating environments for them and allows the natural habitat to do that.
So like many retirees, the pod is going to Florida, which is where the Atlantic bottlenose dolphin is originally from. At least that's the plan. But the aquarium has hit some snags. One of the issues is climate change. It's creating bigger, more powerful storms. So they've been doing some modeling to see where the safest place for the new enclosure will be.
How often do areas get hit by hurricanes? Where do the hurricanes tend to go to land? What has historical damage been? But we also need to keep in mind that there's some factors that may change and we just can't predict them.
That's the wider issue with climate change. It's hard to make the right decisions when you can't exactly calculate the effects. And while they're letting go of the dolphins, they're taking in more sea turtles. We go downstairs behind the dolphin arena to what looks like a deep indoor swimming pool.
So this is our sea turtle rehabilitation area. You can see
inside the pool are a few turtles, numbers on their backs, wading slowly through the shallow pools. Here they care for what are called cold stunned turtles, turtles that have been suddenly exposed to water so cold they get really sick.
They kind of shut down. They can't swim. They don't metabolize properly. They're more likely to get infections, things like that.
The aquarium has seen more and more cold stunned turtles recently. Clayton says climate change is a likely factor with sudden changes in the water.
When we've got nice warm temperatures and then the temperature drops very suddenly, that can catch the turtles unaware.
It's another way in which the aquarium and its resources are having to adapt to climate change. Outside, another experiment in mitigation is underway. The aquarium sits right on Baltimore's Inner Harbor, a bustling area with shops and restaurants, and with water lapping just a few feet from the aquarium's doors. Studies show that the Inner Harbor is likely to flood almost daily due to sea level rise by the end of the century.
So you're welcome to come out.
Great.
To get a better look.
Charmaine Dahlenberg is the director of field conservation at the aquarium. She's standing beside what's called a floating wetland. It's a 400-square-foot prototype, a floating patch of marsh grasses and plants, and underneath are pipes that aerate the water. The aquarium's plan is for more artificial wetlands to fill the harbor around the building.
So they prevent flooding, they lessen the effects of harmful algal blooms, but they're also really good carbon sinks.
Besides absorbing carbon dioxide, these floating green patches help remove pollution from the water while also providing habitat to animals above and below the surface.
Is it better to have something like this than a seawall, for example? It is better. I mean, the seawall does provide some habitat, so you'll get your mussels, your crabs. But what we really want is diversity. Diversity in any kind of environment is so important. And the wetland does that.
Meanwhile, the mission of this aquarium has also been changing. Over 1 million people visit the National Aquarium each year. Megan Anderson does guest outreach here, which since 2012 includes talking about climate change. We met her near the shark exhibit. She says there is a reason they feel they can make a difference.
Aquariums and zoos speak to more people than all sporting events combined, and that people generally that come to aquariums and zoos are coming because they do have kind of a love or a passion for the environment.
She says the facts don't get people to act on climate change in her experience. It's the emotional appeal and giving people a sense of what they can practically do at home.
Washing their clothes in cold water, talking to friends and family about climate change.
It's a message that resonates with Sadie Fernandes, who is at the aquarium with her 2-year-old, Josie.
What do you know about climate change? And are you interested in learning about it when you're here?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I know climate change is real. I know we do need to do better in the environment to make sure everything is sustainable for our next generation.
And Megan Anderson says she's seeing more people like Sadie and Josie who are engaged in this issue. Back with the animals, head vet Dr. Lee Clayton says people's changing attitudes are giving her hope.
We as humans, our behavior changes will absolutely help and make a difference. And the dialogue can be very, very depressing. But when we don't pollute as much, species come back, humans get healthier. So it does make a difference.
She says the next 10 years will be crucial in the fight against climate change. And we all have to do our part.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. In 2009, Najibullah Zazi pleaded guilty to charges connected to a plan to bomb the New York subway system, a plot that was called one of the most dangerous terrorist conspiracies since the September 11th attacks. Zazi and two other men decided not to go through with the attack after they grew worried that law enforcement was onto them. This past week, a federal judge said that Mr. Zazi is a different person, utterly changed from the one involved in that plot. At his sentencing, the judge said that because of his, quote, extraordinary cooperation, Zazi would only do the time he'd already served, about 10 years. So how do you know when a person convicted of terrorism has changed sides? Seamus Hughes, deputy director of George Washington University's Program on Extremism, is with us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about Zazi's story? How did he come to be involved with al-Qaeda?
So him and two of his friends were watching Anwar Laki videos online, and they decided they were going to go join primarily the Taliban, and they traveled to Pakistan. When they got there, they met a number of different connectors and ended up with al-Qaeda. And al-Qaeda realized the benefit of these three Americans that were there, and they sent them back to commit an attack here.
Hmm. There seems to be real agreement between prosecutors and the judge that Zazi's a changed man. What happened?
Yeah, so when Zazi got picked up in the fall of 2009, he immediately started cooperating. And from there on, for the last 10 years or so, he's cooperated against a number of high-profile trials in the U.S., the third in command in al-Qaeda, another American and a British operative. He cooperated with the law enforcement over 100 times, did interviews there. They described his cooperation as extraordinary, some of the best they've seen in terrorism trials.
Do we know why?
You know, sometimes when these things happen, and I've interviewed a few individuals who've joined al-Qaeda and other groups like this, they have an awakening moment when they're looking, sitting across the table from an FBI agent. It becomes very real to them in a way they hadn't seen before. For Zazi's case, he decided that he made a mistake and he wanted to rectify that.
There are three men who were involved in this plot. Two of them cooperated with the government, but the third guy decided to go to trial rather than plead guilty. He's in prison for life now. I don't want to sound cynical, but it does seem like a change of heart is a good legal strategy.
It's a great legal strategy. You know, if Zazi didn't cooperate, he was going to be facing life in jail. The other options is to go to trial. And when you go to trial, universally, you end up getting sentenced to a much longer sentence than you would if you cooperated.
Can you compare how we handle a case like this, which is to do with Islamist terrorism, with the domestic terrorism cases we've been hearing about recently? I'm thinking specifically about white supremacists. Does the government deal with them in the same way?
Yeah, in many ways they do in terms of cooperation. They don't in terms of charges. So you can charge an individual with material support to terrorism as it relates to ISIS or al-Qaeda. You can't have that same statute when it comes to white supremacy. There isn't a parallel statute. For white supremacists, they do flip a lot of individuals, but it's a different approach.
In this case, as you mentioned, they were able to put a lot of pressure to bear to get information, the names of people who were involved. Do you think that's happening with investigators who are dealing with the synagogue shooting suspect, for example?
I think prosecutors they use the court system to bring justice to victims, but they also use it to figure out if there's a larger network they need to be worried about. You know, was this individual, like the synagogue shooter, was he part of a larger group of individuals they should be worried about? Can you get that person to essentially flip on them? And so I'm sure they're having those conversations. And it's a delicate balancing act.
Seamus Hughes, Deputy Director of George Washington University's Program on Extremism. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Sharon Brody in Boston. Tomorrow, the State Gaming Commission meets with a focus on the work needed for the Encore Boston Harbor Casino to open as scheduled next month in Everett. The considerations include the traffic and public safety plans. Wynn Resorts says it expects to serve 8 million people per year. And this week on Beacon Hill, the Joint Committee on State Administration and Regulatory Oversight holds a hearing on some bills, including honorary measures. Bills on the agenda include one establishing that the official amphibian of Massachusetts is the Spring Peeper, and a bill once again calling for designating the official rock song of the Commonwealth as the Jonathan Richman Classic, Roadrunner. It's 50 degrees in Boston, rain today, some fog, temperatures in the low 50s. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Good News Garage, a New England car donation nonprofit accepting, repairing, and providing donated refurbished vehicles to local families in need. GoodNewsGarage.org. Boston University College of Fine Arts. Graduate degrees on campus and online in music, theater, and visual arts. Learn more at bu.edu/CFA. And Giving Joy. The sale of unique handmade jewelry and accessories generates grants for women artisans and entrepreneurs. Learn more at givingjoygoods.com. Dad, you've washed and waxed this car every weekend since you got it. You're donating it, so who cares?
I'm donating it to WBUR, and I'm not giving a mess to Magna.
If you donate your old car, you'll be supporting the news and programming you love. We'll get top dollar for it, and you may be eligible for a tax deduction. Go to WBUR.org/cars, and thanks from Magna and all of us at WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, committed to reimagining banking, offering savings and checking accounts that can be opened from anywhere. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. From Noom, offering a personalized weight loss program that uses psychology, small goals, and technology designed to help people change habits and keep the weight off for good. At Noom, Noom.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Lulu Garcia Navarro, and it's Cinco de Mayo and also time to play the puzzle. Joining us is Will Shortz. He's puzzle editor of the New York Times and Weekend Edition's puzzle master. Hey, Will.
Hey there, Lulu.
All right. What's last week's challenge?
Yes, it came from listener Joseph Young of St. Cloud, Minnesota, who conducts the blog Puzzleria. I said, think of a familiar three-word phrase with and in the middle, blank and blank. Move the first letter of the third word to the start of the first word, and you'll form two means of transportation. What are they? And the phrase is arts and crafts. Make that change, and you get carts and rafts.
We received over 600 correct responses, and our winner this week is Philip Rosen of El Paso, Texas. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
All right. I hear that you are new to the puzzle, which always makes my heart beat faster. It's so nice to have new people come to the puzzle.
Relatively new, yeah. I've been doing it regularly for about a year and a half, 2 years.
And I hear that you're finishing up active duty now from the Army.
I am. I'm currently stationed in El Paso, Texas, and I've been on active duty for 11 years and currently in the process of transitioning to civilian life.
All right. What's next for you?
My family and I are going to be moving to the West Coast.
Nice. All right. Well, are you ready to play the puzzle?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
He says hesitantly.
Yeah. I know. That sounded a little bit like there was a bit of a breath there. All right. Will, take it away.
All right. Philip, every answer today is a familiar two-word phrase or name with the initials SF. For example, if I said eating utensil to the left of the dinner plate, you would say salad fork. So here's number one. genre for H.G. Wells or Ray Bradbury?
Science fiction.
That's right. Number two, place to order a milkshake. Sort of an old-fashioned place.
Soda fountain.
That's it. Up till now.
So far.
Uh-huh. Green Berets, for example.
Special Forces. Better know that one.
Good. Largest city in South Dakota.
Sioux Falls.
Nice. 12 inches by 12 inches.
Square foot.
Uh-huh. Light precipitation in the winter.
Snowfall?
Yeah. And what if it's lighter than a heavy...
Snow flurries.
Snow flurries, that's it. A French expression for the ability to act appropriately in social situations.
Oh. I'm not familiar with any French expressions.
Yeah. That's a tough one. I'll just tell you, it's savoir faire.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Try this one.
Now I know a new expression.
Now you know. Method of people walking one after another.
Single file.
That's it. Founder of psychoanalysis.
Sigmund Freud.
Uh-huh. Traditional Southern African-American cuisine.
Soul food.
Good. Deep hit in baseball that's caught, but that allows a base runner to tag up and score.
Sacrifice fly.
Good. Disparaging term for the U.S. purchase of Alaska.
Seward's folly.
Nice. Emoji that expresses happiness.
Smiley face.
Good. And your last one, feeling around this time of year of restlessness and excitement. And first of all, what season are we in?
Spring. Spring uh-huh. fling?
And what's that? What's that feeling when you just, you're restless and you're excited, you have spring?
Fever.
Spring fever is it. Good job.
You did great. How do you feel?
Pretty good.
Yeah, you're a natural. You should feel pretty good. We're playing our puzzle today. You'll get a weekend edition lapel pin as well as puzzle books and games. You can read all about it at npr.org/puzzle. And Philip, which member station do you listen to?
So for the last 5 years, it's been KTEP, but it will soon will be KOPB.
I like that you've looked into the future and you already know what your member station will be. Philip Rosen of El Paso, Texas, thank you so much for playing the puzzle.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Will, tell us next week's challenge.
Yes, it comes from listener Eric Berg of San Francisco. Name a popular movie of 2018. Add an R. You can rearrange the result to get three different titles for people. What are they? So again, a popular movie of last year. Add an R. You can rearrange the result to get three different titles for people. What are they?
When you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle, and click on the Submit Your Answer link. Remember, just one entry per person, please. Our deadline for entries is Thursday, May 9th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Include a phone number where we can reach you at about that time, and if you're the winner, we'll give you a call, and you'll get to play on the air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times and Weekend Edition's puzzle master, Will Shortz. Thanks so much, Will.
Thanks, Lulu.
Mayo is a time when Americans celebrate Mexico, and Mexicans grumble that Americans have no idea what they're celebrating. This year, there is data to back up that perception. Well, if you can count a poll paid for by avocados from Mexico as reliable data, the poll says that only 22% of Americans know what Cinco de Mayo is actually about. Here's the real history. In 1862, during the U.S. Civil War, the French army marched towards Mexico City. Emperor Napoleon III was eager to establish a second Mexican empire, favorable to the French, an outpost in the New World that would serve as a kind of replacement for all that French land his uncle decided to sell to Thomas Jefferson in the Louisiana Purchase. So he sent a fleet to attack Veracruz, land a force, and head to Mexico City. But they were defeated before they could even get there, at the Mexican city of Puebla, when a young Mexican general named Ignacio Zaragoza beat back the French troops in a bloody confrontation. In Mexico, Cinco de Mayo celebrates that battle, the first battle of Puebla, and it's pretty low-key.
Here in the U.S., it's become a time to enjoy Mexican culture with tequila, guacamole, and tortillas. By the way, there was a second Battle of Puebla, which the French won, and Napoleon III did finally get his second Mexican Empire, but it only lasted a few years. Here in the United States, enjoy Cinco de Mayo. Pitbull, the Cuban-American Miami rapper, also known as Mr. Worldwide or my favorite, Mr. 305, can often be heard shouting his mantra, Dale, in the middle of a song, wearing a pair of aviator-style sunglasses on stage and having a real good time. Dale! One, two, three, four, uno, dos, tres. I know you want me, you know I want you. Swing your body round and round, and then the night is going down. Put it on my life, baby. I'm gonna give you a ride, baby. Can't promise tomorrow, but I promise tonight. Pitbull, whose real name is Armando Christian Perez, has sold more than 65 million records worldwide. But in the past few years, he's gone from making hits to leveraging his fame, from clothing lines to charter schools, and even taking it to the big screen in a new animated film, Ugly Dolls, where he plays the character Ugly Dog. It's about a group of, you guessed it, ugly dolls that realize how to love their imperfections in hopes of finding a child who will love them back. I caught up with him last week in between all his projects at a marina in Miami where his boat was docked, and we had a wide-ranging conversation.
Yeah! Well, thank you for having me.
All right, let's talk about the movie. Your character, Ugly Dog, is a one-eyed, loyal, flirtatious dog. And it seems that you inspired this role. Was that by design?
You know, I thought that they really thought this through and they were real genius about it when they said, hey, Pitbull, we want you to play a dog in this in this animation. I said, well, okay. So when they told me about Ugly Dog, I gave them an idea. I said, hey, look, why don't we do Ugly Dog and then we do a Slick Dog also.
It's all right, guys. Slick Dog's got this.
What are you doing? Having fun, getting crazy, getting loose.
So what I love about it is they gave me a chance and a lot of room to be able to play with the character, which clearly you guys see is pretty much me, just a little blue guy with a little blue dog with one eye.
So I want to ask you about your own childhood. You know, you've been open about the fact that it was rough at times, and you are now one of Miami's most famous sons. Is that weird, the complete change that your life has undertaken? Here you are, like, sitting out in front of the water looking at your boat that just came back from the Bahamas. I mean, it's a long way from where you grew up.
You know, I never looked at my life like it was rough because to me it was just my normality. I thought everybody else was going through the same things at the same time. And growing up in a city like Miami in the 80s, it was basically the cocaine capital. So it being the cocaine capital, I got a chance to see entrepreneurism at its finest at a very young age just with a different product. So what I learned how to do was basically what I tell everybody through my records. I took a negative and made it a positive. It's the same hustle, same mentality, same grind, same struggle, same fight, just a different product. And my product is music. And I always give thanks to Miami, 305, Dade County, the bottom, Magic City, because there's no way I would be who I am and be able to deal with the world the way that I do if it wasn't for this beautiful city.
What is it about Miami that you like?
It's a melting pot. You know, it's a melting pot. You get a chance to grow up around so many different, you know, I've grown up in good neighborhoods, bad neighborhoods, worse neighborhoods. But growing up around so many cultures, it's always allowed me to think out the box and try new sounds and try new things. You learn something new from every culture, just like I learned something new from every record.
You know, I read that your mom came to the U.S. in the Peter Pan program, you know, where children were sent to the United States alone after the revolution.
Correct.
That's an extraordinary journey. And I'm wondering, you've never performed in Cuba. And, you know, right now it's a difficult time on the island. Why not? What needs to happen for you to do that?
Well, for one, my mother did come in Peter Pan. My grandmother was a part of the revolution with Castro and Sierra Maestra until she figured out that wasn't the way to go. And that's exactly why my mother was a part of Operation Peter Pan. So she went from Cuba to Indiana and didn't see, you know, abuela, my grandmother. Some people say it was 4 years. Some people say it was 7 years. So let's just call it 5 years. Either or, it's a long time to be away from your mother and also from your culture.
Of course.
And as far as going back to Cuba, my first time in Cuba was 2001. But I did that strategically before the name Pitbull blew up. And I wanted to at least see what is it that that made our culture so special. So I got a chance to go down there. Why don't go now and do the concert and do what everybody else does? Because then it's just a splash with no ripple effect. I want to make sure that when we go down there, not only do we give the people what they want musically, but we have a plan in place with a strategy on finding a way to open schools down there, to help out with hospitals down there, to help out with neighborhoods down there, to build parks down there, to really have a ripple effect. The same way that we've done in our city is the same way we want to do in Cuba.
Do you have those ambitions to go back to Cuba and open schools like you have in Miami and really help transform the island?
Absolutely. 150,000%. I mean, you're talking to a kid that didn't graduate from high school, but yet is building high schools across the nation. Now, there's certain things, you know, there's obstacles like anything in life. And we'll see how that works out. Pero paso corto, vista larga. That means short steps, long vision. One way or another, it's going to happen. Mark my words. Hmm.
The Billboard Latin Music Awards took place a week and a half ago in Las Vegas.
Yep.
And your music in particular has brought a lot of Spanish culture and language into the mainstream. Latin music is having a moment. I want to get your thoughts.
At this point right now, it's embedded in culture. At this point right now, the reason that it's going to be a bigger movement, or I would even call it a revolution, is because now music is tapped into worldwide, literally. Queremos darle una bienvenida a todas las mujeres que hacen vino por todo el mundo. Yo la conocí en un taxi en camino al club. So you can hear records from different countries on your phone. Before, you didn't have that access. The Latin movement is a major part of it because there's a lot of sounds in a lot of different countries, whether it be Colombia, whether it's in Brazil, whether it's Dominican Republic, whether it's Cuba, whatever it may be, Mexico. So with that said, it's an honor to be a part of the movement, but more than anything, I think that there needs to be a responsibility behind the movement where we make sure that we represent the culture the right way. We make sure that we open doors for those that are coming up, and that to me is the most important part.
This brings me to something else. Obviously, this is a particular moment for the Latino community in the United States.
Yep.
You met with Trump in 2016, and you've been outspoken. Mm-hmm. What's your reaction to what's happening right now?
Well, I can tell you this much. Being Cuban-American, I was already born politically incorrect. So, Trump...
Because many Cubans like him, you know?
No, I mean, there's a lot of people that like him, a lot of people that dislike him. That's the beautiful thing about the United States of America. You can have an opinion, and you have the right to voice it. But... he needs to understand that this country's been built by immigrants. If we're going to talk about Americans, let's talk about Native Americans. And like I always say, you know, they keep talking about the border and the border and the border and the border. Well, the funny thing is that if you do your history, Mexico really didn't cross the border. The border crossed Mexico. And people like Trump, all we got to do is sit back and learn from. But don't let history repeat itself. So, como dicen los cubanos, ponte las pilas. Ponte las pilas means basically get on your game.
Yeah, put your batteries in. I want to just end by asking you, just listening to you talk, you know, it seems that you are very interested in making sure that other people can look at you and say, hey, there is a path forward.
Yes.
That you want to be a role model for a lot of people out there. Is that something that really kind of drives you and what you do right now?
I mean, as far as a role model, I'm not here to be a role model, to be honest with you. I'm just here to lead by example. I'm far from perfect and I'm far from an angel. But I'm here to teach people that failure is the mother of all success. Because for me, like I say, no losing, only learning. No failure, only opportunities. And no problems, only solutions. That's what I always look forward to. And that's why I wake up every day telling the world, come on, baby, let's ride. What you got for me?
That's Pitbull. His new movie is Ugly Dolls. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lulu. I appreciate it. Bidi bing bing bang, yo no quiero tu amor. I just want a really, really, really good time.
Bidi bing bing bang, yo no quiero jugar con tu amor. I tell the truth even when I lie. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. BJ Lederman writes our theme music. I'm Lulu Garcia Navarro, jamming to Pitbull. Mami, estás dura como la raspita, tan caliente que tú salpicas.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Jones Day, an integrated partnership collaboratively providing legal services for more than a century. 43 offices, 5 continents, serving clients as one firm worldwide. Learn more at jonesday.com. And from the ECMC Foundation, celebrating 5 years of philanthropy and supporting efforts to improve post-secondary education for underserved students. Learn more at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is 90.9 WBUR. It's 50 degrees in Boston, coming up on 11 o'clock.
WBUR supporters include Jewish Arts Collaborative, Broadway's Seth Rudetsky and Andrea Burns host Bernstein Reimagined, May 16th at Berklee Performance Center, jartsboston.org. The International Code Council, hosting a global Building Safety Month campaign every May to raise awareness about building safety. More at buildingsafetymonth.org. And Walnut Hill School for the Arts in Natick, celebrating 125 years and still accepting applications for fall admission. walnuthillarts.org/admission.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. As a WBUR listener, you value independent thinking. Maybe you got this value from your mom. Well, now is the time to thank her. Send your mom Winston flowers for Mother's Day and support WBUR at the same time. Order early to save 10%. Call 1-800-909-9287 or see the choices and order yours at WBUR.org.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR-FM Boston,
92.7 WBUA Tisbury,
89.1 WBUH Brewster,
streaming at WBUR.org,
and live at CitySpace, Boston's new home for public conversation.
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.